Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Bale getting it alone! It's scoring for Tottenham! And still Ricky Villa! What a fantastic run! He scored! And he's away, Aaron Lennon! Close! Yes!
Welcome back to another edition of the Internet's most dangerous Tottenham Hotspur podcast, Wheeler Dealer Radio. I am your host, Skipjack, and I am joined by two exciting co-hosts today to analyze a super fun week of Tottenham Hotspur football with no negatives whatsoever. As always, I am joined by my faithful sidekick and trusty outdoorsman, Ben Daniels. Ben, how's it going?
The sky's falling, but other than that, things are pretty good.
Couldn't have put it better myself. And we have a French expert and hopefully soon to be lawyer, Brian Ashlock. Brian, how's it going?
Great. It's good to be back.
Good to
nobody
have you back.
Nobody hopes for more lawyers in the world.
Well, I hope for at least one more lawyer. One more is all I want.
Oh, well. And on that cheery note, we have a fun week to dissect. Yesterday, being Monday, brought much of our fan base to near suicide. But before we get to that fun beat, let's talk about the game against Liverpool, which went exactly as we expected. Right, Ben?
Yeah. I mean, we won pretty comprehensively. The same team that beat QPR came out and just kicked ass. And I think we're all pretty excited about Pochettino.
Yeah, that was not how the game went. Liverpool were comprehensively the better side. If there's any positives to take from this game, I mean, there are some positives to take from this game, but I guess the real positive is that beating wasn't as bad as it looked on the score sheet. I personally think that makeshift back line was just hamstrung the whole team. Brian, what did you think?
Well, I saw someone on Twitter said that, you know, if we keep going at this rate, at some point in 2016, we'll get a scoreless draw because we went from 5-0 to 4-0, now 3-0. So 2-0 next time. So we're improving. I think this is obviously progress from what we've seen in the past. But seriously, I mean – we kind of went into this expecting, or at least I did, that Liverpool were a better side. They had a little more consistency in their team. A lot of their core was the same. They looked okay at the beginning of the season. They played some tougher competition than we had. Brendan Rodgers just got everything right tactically. That the 4-4-2 diamond that he put out there with Sterling was just – I don't know if Pochettino didn't expect it or if we were unprepared for it or whatever, but it was the exact perfect counter to what we were trying to do.
I think you're right in that Rodgers just nailed it. I didn't expect Liverpool to look that good. They hadn't looked that cohesive yet this season. Maybe it's as simple as like giving Lovren and Moreno another week with the team, but Balotelli, I don't think really change the game or anything, but
I disagree. I thought Balotelli was everywhere. I mean, if his finishing was a little better, he could have scored
He changed the game by not making it 6-0.
Okay, fair enough.
Even beyond that, I mean, they had a front three of Sturridge, Sterling, and Balotelli, who are three guys who are fast as fuck, and two of whom are rather physical, and they just ran all over us all day long.
Well, and that's why I think, like, when I was talking about the back line, I mean, obviously any team is going to be affected by a makeshift back line. But if we're trying to run this, like, you know, this sort of fast-paced, pressing system, and we've got a back line with, like, Jan Vertonghen, who's, like, probably still getting a little bit fit, with Danny Rose on the left, who's still adjusting, if we're being nice, to Pochettino's system. And then we've got Eric Dier being drafted into duty as right back, and then the shambling corpse of Yunus Kabul also in the center. I mean, that Kabul especially, but I mean, I feel like the team couldn't press aggressively with a back line that able to get caught out, especially with Kabul. I just think it affected the team's entire game plan, and it's just not well suited to face that front three. I mean, Ben, you and I were talking about how, I mean, Kabul was directly at fault for the first goal, which is, I think, arguably the most important goal of the match.
I think he was at a fault. I mean, he shares culpability in all three goals. The first goal I put almost exclusively on his shoulders, you know, for failing the offside trap. You know, the second goal, yes, it was a dumb penalty. Eric Dier shouldn't have put his hand on him. It was very soft. We can talk about that all day. But that whole Liverpool attack was started by Yunus Kabul needlessly passing the ball straight to Liverpool and just put it straight back under pressure. And then the third goal, you know, yes, Townsend obviously got his pocket picked, and that was terrible. Dier was out of position because we're pushing forward trying to score. But Kabul and Kapu, I guess, they were just not on the same page at all, and nobody shifted over to cover that run from Moreno, and he waltzed 45 yards upfield before burying it. So, I think Kabul was definitely the weak link in the team on Sunday.
Yeah. Brian, what did you think?
I think you really hit the nail on the head earlier when you said that it was so much about the pace of Liverpool. I mean, you have Townsend gives the ball away on the edge of the area in that corner to Moreno, and Moreno leaves him in the dust. And I mean, Townsend is not slow by any stretch of the imagination, but Moreno made him look like he was standing still. And I mean, we've got this philosophy that's built on quickness and physicality. And I think that Tottenham have, you know, one of the most athletic squads in the Premier League, top to bottom. I think when you look at the goalkeepers we have, the central defenders we have, some of the players like Kapu and some of our new signing, I think we're very athletic, you know, all the way up and down the pitch. But we just do not have really game-breaking speed within the squad. And, I mean, the only player really with that kind of pace is Aaron Lennon or a Townsend. And you know, they both have different problems with their end product. And so you saw in Liverpool, you know, like Ben said, three guys up top, fast, know how to finish, know how to distribute. It was just, I mean, everything that Liverpool did worked.
Yeah, I think that to me is ultimately the most frustrating thing about the day. I mean, we didn't look great, but at the same time, that wasn't an awful first. That was a respectable first half. We should have scored twice, or we could have scored twice. I'm always a little less harsh on headers than I feel like a lot of other soccer fans are, because it's so hard to direct them. Chadley got it on target, which is all I can ask.
Chadley definitely should have scored there. That was a big chance for us to get back into the game.
But Addy could have scored two, or Adebayor could have scored two. You know, we had chances, and then, you know, we barely got a chance to see what kind of tactical adjustments Pochettino had made before Dier gives away, you know, what it probably shouldn't be. I mean, Dier shouldn't have been doing what he was doing, but that's also like, you know, Joe Allen going down, like he got shot with a howitzer in his knee, was not helping things.
So my question is, can we ever have like a scenario in which the referee gives the penalty? Because I very firmly believe that that was a penalty. But we have a situation where the referee gives the penalty but still gives the yellow card for embellishment or diving?
That should happen, but I think Sky Sports would explode if that happened.
I mean, it would have to.
I think I was sort of talking to Ed about this in the writer's room. I think that if you really wanted to get rid of that stuff, you should have a committee of officials who penalize that after the fact, like regardless of what happened during the game. I'm not saying you take away the penalty, whatever, but you just, you know, if they go back and look at the film and they use the eyeball test, did Joe Allen dive? Absolutely.
The questionable goals committee, but now it's the questionable penalty call.
You want to stop it? It's like fights in hockey. If you throw everyone out who started a fight in hockey, they'd stop tomorrow. I mean,
well, it's such a hard thing to parse because, I mean, I think – I'm not an expert in the FIFA rules or anything, but I think simulation implies that there was no contact. It doesn't – it's not where a foul was embellished beyond.
There's embellishment. I mean, didn't Bale get booked on that? Like three.
Well,
times.
He got booked for diving for simulation.
I thought he got booked for embellishment too.
I don't think embellishment is a thing.
Well,
and so you know how can we really judge how much of a fall is necessary or warranted by contact? I mean, if there's contact, and it's a penalty, there's contact and it's a penalty, you know, regardless of the embellishment.
Well,
the
space I don't disagree with you, but what I'm saying is I don't know. I just think that the way that Allen goes about winning that penalty, and then, you know, when something happens similarly for Spurs at the other end of the pitch, I think that there's a disparity where, you know, Allen just totally takes his dive, gets his penalty, and then the Spurs player goes down, doesn't get anything.
Well, he didn't go down, and I guess that's the issue.
Right. Yes. I'm sorry. That's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, should Adebayor have embellished? I mean, if there was contact and if it's a penalty, you know, if it's hard for the refs to see it without embellishment, there's always going to be reason to embellish.
But you know what? But you know what the thing about this is, and I guarantee this was the fact. I've seen the littlest people you've ever seen in the world. No, I see very few people giving Joe Allen a lot of stick about this. I see Spurs fans yelling about it. I don't see like many other people. If Adebayor went down like he got shot in the face on that penalty shout, I guarantee you we'd be hearing a lot of garbage about that because he's foreign, because he's got a history of being a little bit of a diva. But Joe Allen's a hardworking Welshman, so I guarantee you we would, it's a different standard for foreign players. I think if you're British, you can get away with it.
Tell that to Gareth Bale.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but how much of that was like a built-up, you know, Bale just kept on doing it? I mean,
I think kind of changing the subject a little bit, but the other thing that I took from this game is that Adebayor does not need to be starting for us. And, amen. I mean, I just continually get frustrated watching him take one touch, two touch, and then give it away, or his first touch just knocks it 6 feet away from his body and a midfielder is able to dispossess him. He looks like a person who does not know how to use his arms and legs in direct concert with the rest of his body.
It's his positioning that bothers me a lot more. It's like he's either offsides trying to get back onsides. Or just – I feel like he always just picks the wrong option. And it's frustrating because we've seen how effective a player he can be. We've seen how unselfish he can be.
There's one point in the match where Spurs have the ball on the outside of the box and Adebayor is on one knee somewhere between the penalty spot and the six-yard box fixing his shoe. I'm like, get back on side. What are you doing?
Yeah, the offside positioning is really what killed it for me. I mean, I've been harsh on Adebayor this season. And yeah, I'm a bit of a Soldado homer, but that said, Adebayor was offside 100% of the time, and not just like the times when he was flagged for offside, but we would win the ball in midfield and we would look for that quick outlet pass to our striker who's supposed to be Adebayor, and he's just strolling back from an offside position, and it kills all of our ability to transition quickly. And Pochettino's entire system is built on those quick breaks, those quick transitions from defense to attack. And when the guy who's supposed to be leading those breaks is offside, it completely neuters our ability to play like Pochettino wants us to.
And I could forgive him being offside if it's he's hanging on the corner of the last defender waiting for that through ball and he just gets it wrong by a shade. You know, I mean, that's fine if that's what it was. But it's literally him just being too lazy to keep up with the defensive line as it moves upfield. Not lazy, that's probably. He's just not – the defensive line is moving upfield and he's not proceeding up the field quickly enough with them. And when Spurs win it back in the midfield, as they have shown a propensity to do this year, he's caught out of position.
Yeah, Adebayor is just – I don't feel like he brings other people into play as much as he needs to. I don't know what it is. Maybe he just needs a more freewheeling system. But I would like to – I mean the heartening thing to me is I think Soldado didn't play because he was hurt. I don't think it's a
– Harry Kane. Free Harry Kane.
Hey, I'm there with you. I mean I can understand why Kane's not getting starts right away because he's a 20-year-old, but –
Right, especially against Liverpool. I get it.
I get it. Like, so like let's not join on the like – you know, Tom Carroll should start against City bandwagon, but you know,
it was Chelsea and he should have.
Oh my God. You're the worst. But I would just like to see someone who's a more inclusive player. Cause you see Lamella, making these interesting runs and, you know, Eriksen sort of poking around the final third. And it was just like, something's not clicking. And I feel like Soldado was so good at sort of drawing these other players in. So even if Soldado's not scoring goals himself, he'll facilitate them.
Yeah, there was a moment that stuck out for me where Chadli has the ball on the left flank and Adebayor kind of like runs over to him and gets right alongside of him instead of being in the box or providing an outlet. And he just, his positioning shows no intelligence for where that play needs to develop. He just wants to drop deep or drop wide and get on the ball without any concept of how the team around him is functioning.
And there's a certain amount of, like, to be fair to Adebayor, he tries shit to a certain extent, and I appreciate that. Like, he'll you know, try to take some guys on. He'll try a little bit of a trick, but it's just not coming off. And, I mean, we saw how effective he was last year with no coaching. So you'd like to think with a competent coach he could do something a little more effective, but whatever it is, it's not firing yet this year.
I was also really disappointed with how our attacking midfielders play. I thought Lamella had a really, really poor game, and he and Chadli both really failed to take advantage of Steven Gerrard being played as the deepest lying midfielder.
Agreed. There was a moment, I don't know if you guys saw it, where Lamella got into the box and made a nice sort of horizontal run, and he was getting into this dangerous position. I'm not necessarily expecting him to shoot there, but it's like, he just sort of passes back to the top of the box and it gets lost in the scrum that Liverpool had up there all day. And it was just, I don't know, like, it's the interesting bit to me about Lamella is you just see these moments of genius. He had this nice sort of no-look pass to Adebayor that was, like, incredible. And it's like, you look at that stuff and it makes you just think of, like, how good can this guy be? And then he just gets suffocated by the Liverpool's pressing game. Now, I don't know if he has a better striker playing alongside him, if that doesn't happen, but...
But, I mean, he didn't really do much in the way of... His pressing was not as effective against Liverpool as it had been against QPR. And now, maybe that's a testament to how good Allen and Henderson are on the ball. But, I mean, he didn't have the type of defensive game that he did against QPR. And that was a little bit... I mean, obviously, when we can't press from the front, we put ourselves under pressure.
Well, I'm going to go back to, you know, Pochettino's lineup and the tactics as what I saw as the explanation for that. You know, I really thought ahead of the game, Lamella pressing on Gerrard would force a lot of turnovers and create a lot of opportunities for us. But what ended up happening was we had Chadli, Eriksen, and Lamella all kind of dwelling in central positions. And we basically gave up the flanks to Liverpool. And Henderson and Allen both pulled wide, and the fullbacks pushed up. And then you had Balotelli, Sturridge, and Sterling taking turns to go wide higher up the pitch. And so when Gerrard would get the ball, he would dish it to either the fullback or to Henderson and Allen wider alongside of him. And there was nobody covering those wider areas. So for all of Lamella's pressing of Gerrard, as long as Gerrard just moved the ball sideways, there was nobody to stop the attack coming down the wings. And that's where all of Liverpool's strong attacks came from. It wasn't through the center. We had the center pretty well controlled with Kapu and Bentaleb and our attacking midfielders who all wanted to occupy those spaces. But it was on the flanks where they just sort of bypassed us. And all the pressing in midfield didn't matter when we had nobody out wide to stop that. And that's where I think someone like Aaron Lennon, you know, for all of his faults going forward, yeah, he may not be the target man goal-scoring presence of Chadli, but he would have given us cover in those positions in a way that the guys we had out there didn't.
I bet you money that he didn't start because of the transfer window. And if that game was next week or 2 weeks or whatever, he would be starting in that game. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I was going to say, I think Ben brings up a good point about Pochettino and his tactics and team selection. And I think what we said, Rodgers got it completely right there. I think we also have to acknowledge that Pochettino got it almost totally wrong.
Yep.
I think we all understood that. I think it was pretty well known by midweek that Balotelli was going to be making his debut. And I'm not sure. I mean, it's not like they've not played this sort of diamond midfield before. I mean, Liverpool's used it against Pochettino's Southampton before.
Yeah, it beat them with it after losing to Pochettino the first time around. It seemed like Rodgers very much had Pochettino's number.
So it's, I mean, if I'm Pochettino, I should be expecting this formation. And I mean, I went back and looked because I saw something on Twitter, and again, I wish I could credit whoever it was, but they said that last season, Southampton, they only won I don't know how to phrase this. Basically, here's what happened. They won 15 games. They kept 13 clean sheets. They only won two games in which their opponents also scored.
Hmm. Wow.
So that makes me think that Pochettino doesn't really have a plan B. When his opponent scores first, you know, he doesn't know how to change the game. I mean, the plan still stays the same, and admittedly it's an effective plan, but sometimes you need to change it up and you need to make a switch in tactics. I'm not saying I think he's an ideologue, but I don't know, what his backup plan is. Southampton last year, they only gained 6 points from losing positions, and they dropped more points from winning positions than any other team in the league. So if you could hit back Pochettino's Southampton team, you could had a good chance of getting a result out of the game.
Now, part of that, I think, is down to Southampton's just total lack of squad depth. They didn't have any game changers in a way that
absolutely,
he does at
Spurs. Absolutely, I agree. And I mean, I don't think he had a top quality striker. And, you know, I think some of the resources that he was working with are not of the level that you're working with at Spurs.
Right. I think that's just going to be a lesson that Pochettino can hopefully learn, is how does he use those fringe players and those plan Bs to improve on what's happening on the pitch, because it wasn't an option available to him before. So it's all kind of new for him.
Well, my question is, with the squad as it is now, and you have your best 11 out there, now who are your game changers? Who is available to us on the bench that is really a guy that can come on and change the dynamic of the way we play? You have is it just Kane and Soldado?
Well, you've got Lennon and Townsend, who also provide different things.
But are they match winners per se? I think Townsend has it in him.
Kane, definitely.
I don't know that they need to be match winners. I don't need to know that Aaron Lennon needs to come on and take the game over and win the game single-handedly. But I think, you know, when the plan A isn't working for various reasons, if you throw on a different element like Aaron Lennon that the team you're playing isn't used to or isn't set up to defend against, you know, that can allow some of those other guys to flourish in a way that they may have been stifled before. And so while he may not be the guy who's going to, you know, single-handedly win you the game, he'll change the game in a way that lets your guys like Lamella or Soldado or whoever be better.
Well, to me, I like the idea of starting with Lennon a little better. Sorry, Greg.
No, no worries.
I like the idea of starting with Lennon better because, as you said earlier, he gives you much more defensively, and he also has that pace to hit on the counterattack. And then because I think a player like Chadley or Townsend offers a little bit more in the closing stages in the way of actually being able to contribute a goal. I don't really count on Aaron Lennon to come on and either score a goal or assist a goal.
Well, I mean, I don't count on Townsend to score a goal, because that never actually ends up happening, against good teams at least. But I think it's interesting we were talking about ability to change the game, because I've been very impressed with Pochettino's subs so far this year. I think it helped change the dynamic of the West Ham game. We definitely won against AEL in the first round because he threw Lamella on. Now, arguably, that's not that impressive because it's Lamella against, you know, that team. In this game, he was at least trying something interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure if I would take it off Eriksen, but Andreas was clearly sent on to sort of run at Liverpool and stretch them back a little bit. Now, that all went horribly wrong right away, and it sort of negated the impact of the sub. But I think his substitutions, in terms of switching things up, have been kind of impressive so far. We'll see how he takes that forward in different kinds of matches. And coming, you know, when he has to come from behind against a real team and not, you know, a Europa League qualifying team. But I don't know. It's still early days for Pochettino, and I, you know, it's probably too early to say one way or the other. Were there any positives that we're taking from this game? I would say my own, despite the penalty, I thought Dier looked not completely out of his depth, even though we did get burned on the flank. He wasn't quite as – I just don't think it was a disaster that many people were expecting.
And that tackle on Balotelli was awesome.
Yeah.
If only for that, I'm happy with Dier.
I think the biggest positive for me anyway was I am increasingly convinced that a Benteleb-Capu midfield is viable against top teams. I thought that Benteleb struggled at times, but I thought he didn't look – at all out of his depth. I thought, he had other problems with the people around him that weren't, you know, his fault. I think that, you know, the continued development of him is going to be huge for us this year. And if he plays, you know, 25, 30 Premier League games as a starter, I mean, who knows where he could be this time next year.
He's not there yet, but he sure does look like a guy who gets it right now, doesn't he? Or he's going to get there, rather. I mean, I'm probably most confident of all our young players that Bentaleb will be a starting Premier League player one day, if not for us, but for someone else. But I mean, he looks like he's getting close.
I mean, he's a starting Premier League player already.
Well, long term, I mean, yes. Okay.
And I mean, not to give Capoue short shrift or anything, but I mean, when he came here last year, I thought that his transfer didn't make any sense, and that he was kind of surplus to requirements. He was just kind of buying to buy because he was cheap. He did not play kind of this well when he was at Toulouse in France. He presses well. His passing is so much better. I've never seen him display the quality of passes and the range of passes that he's displayed this year. At Toulouse, he just tried stuff, and he'd send long balls, and no one could ever hope to get on the end of. But here for Spurs, he's looked great in these first three games.
His turnaround this year I think it's Pochettino's most impressive work on this team so far. I think our Twitter account was saying something to that effect, because Lamella was always going to sort of figure this out somewhere. But man, like, I mean, Capoue looks like, I mean, I know he was impressive in those first few games last year before his injury, but like you said, Brian, he wasn't passing like this. I mean, this is nice. This is a very nice player to have in your side.
Yeah, I'm impressed with his, he just plays with his head up, and he seems to see those like raking long balls on the ground up to the forward line, which you really rarely see from a player who plays as deep and is, you know, is so primarily focused on breaking up play. But his ability to switch the ball from defense to attack is huge for how Pochettino wants to play, and he's going to be so key to our fortunes this season.
Ben, I want to focus on something you just said, because I feel like we've actually used this to describe different players at various points of the preseason and season, head on a swivel. There's maybe one difference I'm seeing throughout the whole team since Pochettino's gotten here is, I mean, they're really looking for passes a lot quicker, have better sort of positional awareness and awareness of their teammates than I think we've seen since God Harry was here. I mean, just the sort of awareness of what's going on around them seems so much better this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a key to how Pochettino's setup works. It's, you know, because it's so geared around that quick transition, everybody kind of needs to be aware of where everybody is around them, and they need to know what to do with the ball as soon as they get it. And so I think you're right. We've seen a lot from a lot of our players, you know, looking around before they receive the ball and once they receive the ball so that they can make a quick decision and release the ball forward as quickly as possible. And I think Pochettino's done a great job getting that message across really quickly.
Yeah, the press isn't quite there, as we saw against Liverpool. And I think it wasn't great against West Ham, and it wasn't great against Liverpool. And I think, you know, we talked about how against West Ham we're not going to do that necessarily because Poch is in an ideologue. And, you know, West Ham could catch us out going over the top like they did last year. And I think against Liverpool, and I would maintain this is largely because of our back line is so rusty or creaky right now. We were scared to sort of do a full-on press against Liverpool because we're so worried about getting caught out at the back with guys like Kabul. Brian, where do you see the press going forward for this team? Is it?
Well, I mean, I think with any Pochettino team, it starts, you know, at the front. And I think that in at least the wide midfielders, you definitely have players that are willing and able to effectively disrupt the opposition. I think where the press becomes more problematic is where you get into the center and when teams are going to play through the center. Now, that falls primarily on Christian Eriksen. It's got to be Christian Eriksen's job to pressure the deepest lying midfielder. And in this Liverpool game, it was him who should have had the responsibility of being on top of Steven Gerrard at every opportunity. And we saw Gerrard still had plenty of time on the ball. He was able to get it and shift it wherever he needed to shift it. So I think in terms of the press, it really has to come from either Eriksen being more active or pairing Eriksen with a more active forward, someone like Harry Kane, who will drop in between the lines and press back on that defensive midfielder and allow Eriksen just float around and receive the ball once the press has taken the ball back.
So just to quibble minorly with you, Lamella was playing centrally and Eriksen was playing nominally on the right in that match. So it was, I would say it was Lamella's job to be on Gerrard.
But I mean, the way it's set up, it's so fluid. I mean, I'm not good. I just distinctly remember much of the time Lamella drifting out wide. I'll accept if I'm wrong. That's fine. But I mean,
I just pulled up the 4-4-2 stat zone average position map, and it's and this shows Lamella more central than Eriksen, but Eriksen also playing much more like a second central attacking midfielder than a wide player. But he is a little wider than Lamella.
See, to me, Lamella and Chadli seem to interchange so much that, you know, switching back and forth between the left and the right, and Eriksen is, to me anyway, almost consistently playing centrally. And so I feel like he, so far anyway, has not done enough in terms of his pressing. But, you know, if it's the case that Lamella is playing more centrally and it's Lamella's job to mark out Gerrard, then I will accept that I was wrong.
Well, I mean, the press is not quite there yet. But I think, unlike maybe as we saw under ABB, at least for the moment, it seems to be more of a case of us feeling it out and developing it as opposed to what the hell are we doing. If nothing else, we're moving around and pulling guys around, which is comforting to see.
I think one of the things Brian mentioned, though, is important, is that because Chadli and Eriksen and Lamella are kind of floating all over the place in a way that's great for our attack, it can certainly cause the press to suffer because nobody's really, you know, locked into a defined zone of the pitch to say, okay, this is my responsibility. I have this area. I should be pressing here. You know, they're all kind of floating around everywhere. And so I think that makes it harder for them to understand exactly who's my guy, where should I be focusing, you know, my defensive energies.
Well, and hopefully that'll click eventually. And they'll just sort of figure, because you would assume that's part of the system, but, you know, who knows? I guess we will see. I think that's enough talk, unless you guys have anything else you want to add about Liverpool. I think I'm done analyzing that sorry state of affairs. I'm ready to write it off as, you know, a much more practiced team against a team still learning its coach's philosophy. I think that's a fair way to sort of approach this game, as opposed to, well, we're mid-table at best and the sky is falling, especially when I don't think any other top six teams gained points on us or got anything more than a draw that weekend.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen what went wrong, and now it's up to Pochettino to fix it, and we'll see what happens against Sunderland next week.
Yeah, in 2 weeks. At least we've had a dominant offensive performance. Arsenal can't say that. United can't say that. Well, City can say that. But, you know, it's not the end of the world. I wish we didn't have an international break this week so we could get that bad taste out of our mouth. But we have another thing to put more bad taste in our mouth, and that's the transfer window. The transfer window slammed shut on Monday as deals were wheeled and dealed, as this podcast likes to say. Not a whole lot for Spurs. We sold some guys. We finalized Stamboli. Is that how you say it, Brian? Brian, hello?
Sorry, I had it on mute.
Oh, no worries.
Stamboli.
We finalized him, but everyone knew that deal was in the works. We sold Sandro. We sold Holtby. We tried to sell Aaron Lennon, but that didn't happen. And we cleared out some of our youth ranks that just didn't seem like they were progressing. Do you guys want to start on our acquisition, or do you want to start on our sales? Brian, pick.
I mean, I'm fine. Let's talk about all the acquisitions.
Okay, let's start with the most recent ones. We'll sort of go to a more holistic look at the transfer window at the end. Stamboli, we got him from Montpellier. Montpellier, thank you.
Jesus.
For those who don't know, Brian is our French football expert, but I should still be able to pronounce this stuff. we got him from there. He was their vice captain. He's a very young player. A lot of people are comparing him to Schneiderlin. I think he's definitely plan B because Southampton priced us out of Schneiderlin. Brian, you've watched a lot of Ligue 1. What do you think of him?
I think he's kind of exactly the player that Tottenham need. I think he's much more similar to a Schneiderlin or a Capu than he is to a Sandro. He's versatile in that he can play defensive midfield, center back. He's even played a little bit of right back in his career. You know, he's a guy who's confident on the ball. And much like Capu has shown, he's able to break up play and then quickly distribute the ball into attack. He doesn't really dwell on the ball. He's not sort of a creative player or anything, and he's not going to score any goals or make some crazy assists. But, you know, he does like to dribble. So in that, he's a little bit like Dembele. He's also very strong in terms of his positioning. So I think he's a good acquisition. I think in terms of squad depth, I think he's great. You need players like him who are sort of utility knife players who are, you know, he has a great work rate and he works well within a team concept. So I think in terms of like Spurs' second team and the squad that's going to play in the Europa League and the cup competitions and, you know, any sort of injuries that may happen, I think he's perfect.
So do you see him as just Capu's backup, or do you think there can be a room for him and Capu to play alongside each other?
I think playing him and Capu alongside each other would be a very negative midfield. I think that if you were going to do that, it would have to be against a team that was like Chelsea or Manchester City, and you would have to be almost certainly playing for a draw. Tottenham would be better served playing with Moussa Dembele or Paulinho alongside.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Right, I know. alongside Capu, just because they give a little bit more going forward. You know, he scored 5 goals in something like 130 or 140 matches for Montpellier. So he's not a threat to score a goal. And, you know, he's only had, you know, 6 or 8 assists probably in his career. He's really just a guy who lays the ball off to the better attackers, puts himself in good positions, draws people out of positions in the attack if he has to. But he's not the kind of guy that's going to be the playmaker in your midfield.
Given what we talked about with Capu's, you know, really promising-looking long-range passing and creativity that he's shown so far, do you see it working if Stambouli is the more defensive of the two and we kind of let Capu off the chain a little bit? And let him dictate play going forward?
I think that's certainly possible. I mean, Capu has shown an ability to hit, you know, to be an offensive player in Liga. He scored more goals than Stambouli anyway. I think the thing you lose with playing Stambouli as your more defensive midfielder is he's a little bit smaller. He's only 5'10", 5'11". He's still very physically strong and very committed to a tackle. He's very much in the sort of like English defensive midfield mold, sort of like a Lee Cattermole if he like knew how to play football type thing. So I think that could work. But again, I think that would still be a very negative midfield.
Well, I think what strikes me about the signing, other than, I mean, it looks like we really got a deal by sort of stealing a march on Fiorentina. Which is even more funny considering that we usually get criticized for how long our transfer dealings take. I think we signed him 10 minutes after the first, like, rumors about it came out. We seem to be doing like for like in a lot of positions, which Vorm and Lloris probably is the one that strikes me the most, but it seems like we want to have guys who play in a similar way to our starters or other players, so it's not as much of a culture shock when we bring these guys in, which I guess that's the positive aspect. The negative aspect might be that you don't have like a different look at when plan A is not working. Do you think this is a strategy, or do you think it's just another coincidence, Ben?
No, I think this is definitely a strategy of Pochettino's. I mean, he clearly, you know, I don't know that he's not an ideologue, despite our hopes to the contrary, but it seems like he very, very deliberately has a way he wants the team to look and is trying to make sure he has guys in those positions and depth in those positions to play those same roles. I mean, we saw, you know, him try and clear out Townsend and Lennon to bring in Welbeck or Jay Rodriguez. So we could kind of double up on that Chadley, Welbeck, Rodriguez, left wing forward kind of role at the expense of something different. So that does give me a little concern that, you know, he might not be willing to go outside of his little box. But that said, I think if he can get the team playing exactly how he wants, you know, that plan A might be good enough to take us as far as we need to go.
I mean, there's something to be said for guys who fit the game plan. I mean, whether or not it's an ideologue, and we'll get to him in a second. There's the part of the reason Holtby's not here is he's a square peg in a round hole for this team's strategy, or at least that. Like I said, that's not all of it, but that's part of it. I think it's the consistency thing is encouraging as far as I'm concerned. Which I think the consistency thing about how he wants to build the squad brings us to who we got rid of on transfer deadline day. Spurs sold Sandro, Spurs sold Holtby. This has been met with much wailing and gnashing of the teeth. Before we get to what will make me happy, let's talk about Sandro. I think he is probably one of the best players, or has certainly put in some of the best performances of the sort of, you know, most recent era of Tottenham Hotspur. On his day, I think he was maybe the best defensive midfielder in the world. The problem, of course, with him is his days are very rare because he's hurt all the time. Brian, do you think he got sold due to injury? Do you think there are other reasons? Why do you think Sandro is not on Tottenham right now?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. I think the injury is a significant part of it. I think there's no club that's in a better position to assess a player's fitness than Tottenham, or that player's fitness than Tottenham. I think, and Spurs generally aren't a club to give up on a player just because of injury. I mean, you look at, you know, what we put up with through Ledley King's career, and,
or Jonathan Woodgate,
Or even Jonathan Woodgate. So, I mean, you know, to me, Spurs have to know that, look, he's not going to be the same player ever again. Or if he is, he's only going to be able to manage it in fits and spurts. And, you know, yes, it pains me to lose Sandro because, you know, his contributions to the team that qualified for the Champions League and, you know, so many other great memories.
In the Champions League.
Right. And you know, like, I'm going to miss him, but he doesn't fit in really to what Pochettino does. And I mean, you know, I've seen, you know, the criticisms of his passing game, and, you know, I've made some of those criticisms as well. And that's really the issue here is Sandro is a decent passer of the ball. He's not, you know, Jean-Obi Mikel, but he didn't have the kind of range that Kapu and Stambouli bring. And, you know, while he is sort of great as an all-action presser, I wonder how his positioning is at times because, like Lewis Holtby, his enthusiasm to press and to tackle often drew him out of position. So I think we're looking for a more tactically disciplined player, a much better passer, and I don't think Sandro really provided that.
Well, the other thing about Sandro is, and I mean, this is not worth keeping a guy around, but, you know, he was fun. It's fun to have a player like Sandro on your team. He seemed to enjoy being here. He was, you know, he was fun to watch play. You know, the stuff he sort of, we saw through social media was, you know, it always seemed to be very, you know, enjoyable. But
wait, are you talking about Lewis Holtby?
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a minute. The players seemed to like him. But, you know, and that sucks. And it sucks to lose a player like that. But you can't overlook. I think the one thing you didn't mention, Brian, was his contract's running down. And, you know, if he's not willing to sign an extension, we can't keep him.
And Stambouli signed a 5-year deal.
Exactly. If he's
not. That keeps him, Stambouli, here until he's 29 or almost 30.
And gives us leverage if we ever want to sell him. So. I mean, if he's not going to give us the leverage that we need, if we don't think he's fit enough, and let's not forget he got into some ugly business with the higher-ups last year. Now, I know it was Sherwood, but, you know, if he's kicking up a fuss in the locker room, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if a new manager doesn't want him there potentially undermining him. Now, that might not be what we all want to hear, what we all want to think of Sandro, but, you know, if we're looking for rationale as to why this has happened, I think it's there. What I think is telling is that Napoli dropped out of this, and they didn't want him. Or at least they weren't willing to pay £10 million for him, which...
Well, Napoli really shat the bed in their transfer window. I mean, they were in for Sandro, they were in for Fellaini, they were in for Lucas. And
Napoli should have been able to afford him for £10 million.
Ended up with a very, very much, you know, their fourth-choice defensive midfielder. So I don't know if we could read much into Napoli not...
Napoli didn't make Champions League.
Yeah, maybe they get him if they're in the Champions League. But my point is... If QPR is the team that buys Sandro for £10 million, and I know QPR have a little more money than a team at their level probably should, but I think that says something about the market for Sandro. And I think that says something not good about Sandro. I don't know if that's health. I don't know if that's locker room character. I don't know what that is.
I don't know that Sandro ever really got a lot of attention beyond Spurs. I mean, we all love him. We all thought he was great. But, I mean, if you asked most fans of other teams, they would not have pointed to Sandro as somebody who was particularly good.
Yeah, but fans of other teams aren't scouting other teams, though. I mean,
I don't know how much teams are scouting other teams.
Well, he's been linked with Italy since that AC Milan game. Like, every Italian team, I feel like, has been linked to him, like Napoli every damn year. So that no other Italian teams were in for it. I think that maybe I'm overreading this. I think that says something about Sandro's market value, that he only went for $10 million and it was to QPR.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does say something about his market value, but I don't know that market value has a lot to do with his ability as a player.
That's fair, I guess,
is my point.
That's fair. I mean, you know what? I hope Sandro has a great year. I hope he takes a lot of points off of other teams around us. I hope he has a fantastic career. I wish Sandro nothing but the best. Moving on to our other sale was Lewis Holtby, who went to Hamburg on a loan deal, probably to be sold next year for €6 to 7 million, which is still a tidy profit, I suppose. This is probably the one that makes people really sad, too. What makes me angry about it is it's sort of being lumped in with Sandro, because Lewis Holtby made people happy with his selfies on Instagram. And the difference between him and Sandro, as far as I'm concerned, is Sandro could be one of the best defensive midfielders in the world, and I can count Lewis Holtby's memorable moments on the pitch on one hand, and if we're disqualifying Europa League group games, I can count them on, like, two fingers. So... Lewis Holtby was a guy who came in here with a lot of potential, and for whatever reason, he didn't succeed at Spurs. Ben, you love Lewis. Tell me why I'm wrong about this.
You're wrong because I think, while you're right that he never put it together on the pitch in the way that Sandro has for us to warrant the fond memories, prospectively, I think Lewis Holtby had a lot more potential to be a contributor this year than Sandro did, especially, you know, how we were able to replace him with Stambouli. Lewis Holtby is... You know, I've banged this drum for a while, but he's the only guy who his skill set remotely replicates what Lamela and Eriksen do on the pitch.
In theory.
In practice. Even if he's not as good as them, which, yeah, he isn't. But I still think, you know, God forbid someone gets injured, you need to have, you know, a backup who's capable of replicating that role, even if it's less effective. You know, I think, you know, if Holtby got like a extended run in the team with an Eriksen injury, you know, who knows if he could have started to deliver. But I don't like losing that depth option. I don't like, you know, Holtby is a guy who could have played alongside the two of them in place of either of them. He could have played in place of Benteleb alongside Kapu, as he did in preseason, to pretty good effect. He was a guy who was able to fill in a lot of places in the midfield. And without him, I worry what our depth looks like if anything happens.
I hear that. I'm not as terrified because I think we can play certain guys. Dembele, I think Paulinho maybe, although that's terrifying. I guess when I'm looking at that transfer, I think Holtby wanted to be a starter, and that wasn't happening. I think it's telling that a new manager doesn't want him here. I think Holtby is also the victim of circumstance. We bought him not because we had him filling a role. We bought him because somehow, some way, this deal for this prospective player fell into our lap, and we took it. the problem that Holtby had was, A, he came into a team midway through the year where they hadn't really planned on him. Then Gareth Bale blew up being played in the position that Holtby should have been played in. And then we bought Christian Eriksen. So Holtby kept being blocked. And when I think it has to be said, when he got his minutes on the pitch, he didn't really impress versus many good teams. That Fulham performance is the only, like, really quality performance out of him that I can think of. And that was a halftime sub. So I don't know. I think he was a YouTube player for us. And he'll go to Hamburg and prove me wrong. But I'm just not sorry to see him go, because if he was willing to be a bench player, which I don't think he was, then great. But I don't think that was going to happen. And if that wasn't going to happen, this was the move to make. Brian, do you have any thoughts on Holtby?
No, I think both of you have summed up my thoughts pretty well on this. I think Lewis Holtby could have been a big asset to the club, because I really don't think we have anybody on the squad now that even remotely fills in Eriksen's shoes or even Lamela's shoes. But I also agree that I think he definitely wanted to be first team. I think that's why he went on loan to Fulham last year. I think that's why he would consider a loan back to Germany at this point, and especially to such a horrible team as Hamburg. I expect if Hamburg get relegated, he'll come back. And we'll have to sell him again next summer. But I would have liked to keep him around, if nothing else, for depth. And because, like I said earlier, he changes the game. He's one of the substitutes that you can bring on, and he is something different than an Eriksen or a Lamela. But I understand why he felt – if he wanted to go, then I totally understand why he wanted to.
Well, he's gone now, and like I said, I'm sure that he'll prove me wrong or look annoyingly good at Hamburg. I'm curious to see if he might end up being a player kind of like we think Sigurdsson is, where he's good if the team's sort of running through him. But if he's just a role player, he might not shine quite as much. But we'll see. He'll have his opportunities now because, God, they're going to need him. Ben, do you have any final thoughts on Holtby? Or?
I miss you.
Wow, that was super creepy.
Sad and pathetic. At the
yeah,
same time.
Yeah. The perfect capstone for the Lewis Holtby years at Spurs. He took cute pictures, and that's about it. The other move that was going on transfer day of note was we were apparently trying to flog Aaron Lennon to anyone who would take him. QPR said no. He said no to QPR rather, and I think Hull. But basically, he didn't want to go play for a lower tier side. I have seen people likening this to Michael Dawson refusing to go. I don't think it's quite the same thing, if only because I think Aaron Lennon still has something to offer Spurs. I understand the criticism of Lennon, but I think he offers a lot defensively on the right wing, and I think he really brings a pace to the side, even now, that I don't think we really have. Brian, do you have any – what are your thoughts on Lennon sticking around?
Aaron Lennon is 27 years old, guys. I feel like Aaron Lennon has been around for like 50 years.
I feel like he's 80. It's like Harry Kane's 50. Aaron Lennon's 80. I don't understand how they're so young.
I mean, Aaron Lennon made his debut for Spurs in 2005. I mean, we're going on 9 years and almost to 10 years that he's been at Spurs. And he's still only 27. And this, I understand why you would want to sell him. I think he's just a pure out and out winger. I think in this particular system, he's not as effective as he could be in a system where, you know, you're actually using the wingers to get to the byline and cross. But I think that also limits the market for him. And, you know, when there's a limited marketplace and, you know, the few sources that could use him don't want him or can't afford him because he is going to be an expensive player. He is probably on high wages, and Spurs probably value him very highly. You're not going to be able to just get rid of him that easily. I think it's good that we keep him around because he does have that pace, like you mentioned, Greg. But I think in the long term, I think his usefulness to Spurs is relatively limited.
Here's the other thing. Go ahead, Ben.
I just disagree completely about what Lennon has to offer. I mean, Lennon's entire career, he's been, a fast guy who goes down the wing and puts in a shitty cross. And that is of limited utility in 2014. But I don't think that's the best use of Aaron Lennon. And I think Pochettino given the system he wants to play, will, if he wants to use Lennon, will have to mold Lennon into the kind of guy he needs. I mean, we saw, you know, when AVB came in, Lennon was the obvious man out as someone who didn't fit the side and wouldn't contribute. You know, he's not a Hulk. He's not an inverted winger. He's not Varela on the other side. He just didn't seem to have a place. And I thought Lennon was one of the players who took to AVB's system better than anyone, frankly. I think we've seen Lennon throughout his career show an intelligence and a coachability that most of our players, that most players don't have. And I think, you know, we saw our best game in preseason came when Lennon was playing alongside Eriksen and Lamela. And Lennon was able to float around the pitch and make quick passes with those two guys and then break forward behind the defense and chase on to through balls. And while, yeah, he's not the guy you necessarily want going one-on-one with the keeper, you give him enough chances and he'll put one away. I just think if we give Lennon the chance to not be that guy who's fast and puts in bad crosses, he will take to it. And I think he has a lot more to offer than most people expect. You know, Lennon's a guy who has, in his almost 10 years at Spurs, seen so many players come and go who were supposed to take over his position and never managed it. And I would be pretty surprised if Lennon doesn't show us one more trick up his sleeve and sticks around a little longer than we expect.
I think it's entirely possible Andreas Townsend ends up on that bone pile. I think you're right, Ben. I think you nailed it. I think Aaron Lennon is much more takes instruction better than I think a lot of people give him credit for. And I think he will do what is asked of him. Now, I think he's got a semi-limited skill set, but I think what you said about him under AVB rings very true for me. He is – everyone thought he was tactically limited. He was, you know, from a sort of a bygone era, just like Jermaine Defoe. And until he got hurt against Inter, he was having a great year. I mean, he wasn't scoring a million goals, but he was being dangerous, creating problems for defenses. I think there's a use for Aaron Lennon, and I don't – it's not like Dawson where it was just, oh, he's a team leader and he psychs people up and maybe he can, like, outhead a dude. Like, I think there's a real use for Aaron Lennon on this team. I want to take a very quick look at the transfer window as a whole, who we brought in. I think it's clear that we were targeting defense, and more defense. We brought Ben Davies in. We brought Fazio in. We brought in Michel Vorm. We brought in DeAndre Yedlin, although that's not right away.
Eric Dyer.
We brought in Stambouli. I mean, we didn't necessarily get the players we wanted. We weren't able to get Musacchio due to just sort of Villarreal needing us to double our transfer fee to make it worth their while. We didn't get Schneiderlin because Southampton has fuck you money right now. But I think we targeted players similar to that and got what we needed. I think what's also interesting, at least in Fazio and Stambouli, is that I think we got players who were leaders of their teams. And I think, you know, everyone's like, oh, who's going to be our captain? Alec Dawson is gone. I'm not saying they're going to be our captains, but I think we're targeting a certain type of player. And I think we did a fair job in acquiring them. I mean, Brian, your thoughts on the window overall?
I thought it was a good window. I think when you look at I really obviously rate Stambouli. I think Fazio is really good. I just remember Fazio from Football Manager, like back in 2008, 2009. Fazio was amazing in Football Manager. You had to buy him, and then all you had to do was just like train him in like his agility and quickness a little bit, and he was the world's greatest center back. In reality, that didn't happen. He's kind of still slow.
Well, he had it was an ankle injury, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I mean, I think that Fazio is – I think he's a good purchase. I think I think Ben has mentioned this or several people have mentioned this on the site that Fazio knows he's slow and so understands how to play as a slow person, whereas someone like Yunus Kabul, who was always kind of very quick but has now lost a step, doesn't know how to play as a slow person. I think the window as a whole was good. I think the squad as a whole got younger. I think when you look at the purchases, only Vorm and Fazio are over 25, I think. You've got Dyer, Yedlin, who are very young. Davies, also very young. Stambouli at 24. I mean, and the players we get rid of or some of the older members of the squad. So I think that this is a sort of window that's transitional. I think it's better than last summer where we bought in all those players. And, I mean, not that we bought any less this summer, but, you know, they were being forced into the squad last year, and these guys are going to have to, at least some of them anyway, are going to take time to integrate into the squad, and we don't need them to produce right away.
Well, aside from Fazio, I think your point's well taken about that these guys can be sort of integrated. I think one of the criticisms we've also seen is that, Levy's not backing Pochettino because he's not getting him his guys. Well, I mean, I guess that's true, but at the same time, we're mocking Harry Redknapp for not knowing who to sign other than players he's already coached at other teams. You know, we tried to get Schneiderlin, we tried to get Musashi. I think there's very legitimate reasons we didn't get either. But it's, you know, I mean, Pochettino is A, Argentine, and B, he would have seen Fazio up close when he coached in La Liga. So I'm assuming he's very familiar with him. You know, I would have to assume that Stambouli is so like for like in terms of Schneiderlin that was a scouting decision. And, you know, if it's 26, if it was going to cost us 26 million to get Schneiderlin and we paid what, 5 for Stambouli, I mean, that's insane if you don't take it. You can't pay that. Tottenham Hotspur cannot pay that much for a player like Morgan Schneiderlin, as much as I think he would improve our squad. Ben, do you think we're not backing the manager here? Do you think these are good signings that reinforce what he's doing? What's your opinion on the window?
Well, I think the idea that we're not backing the manager is absurd. I mean, as you said, there's legit reasons we didn't get the first choice guys, but we moved very decisively to get the backup alternative players. And
fill
I really
those
don't...
same needs.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it looks like we very much had a plan. You know, I don't want to belabor this since I already wrote about it on the site, but, you know, we all knew Pochettino's mission was, hey, we signed 7 guys last year. None of them besides Eriksen really did shit. Your job is to get those guys clicking with the squad, and if we do that, we'll be a better team. And so I think we fixed the areas that, you know, we didn't think the players would just improve, and that was the defense, and I think we're 100% correct. You know, we needed to make that younger and better, and we did. And now Pochettino's got to coach the attack to get the best out of guys like Lamela and Soldado and Paulinho and Chadli, and he seems perfectly poised to do that. You know, I don't want to be like the Arsene Wenger. Abu Diaby is like a new signing, but all of those 6 guys, not Christian Eriksen, are basically like new signings this year, given how little they contributed last season.
Lamela is definitely like a new signing. Like, he barely played for us last year.
Yeah, he had his first start in the league against West Ham. What? Ugh. Like, that's insane. I think we had the talent to begin with to improve our team, and Pochettino's job is to now make it work on the pitch.
I think the only area we didn't really improve that we seem to be targeting was left wing forward, or a left-sided forward. We were targeting at various points in the window Jay Rodriguez, which would have obviously been a long-term move because that dude's probably not back for a few months. We were targeting Danny Welbeck, which, boy, the disappointment on losing out to Danny Welbeck was kind of amusing, considering I feel like if you told Spurs fans last summer that we would be after Danny Welbeck, they would have killed you. Brian, what are your thoughts on Welbeck? And what, I mean, was that a huge miss for us? Should we have paid that much money for him that what Arsenal paid? I mean, what do you think?
I mean, I think the the numbers on Welbeck suggest that he's really probably not that good. And I think that, like, if you look at advanced statistics or whatever that, you know, according to people like Ted Knutson or Knutson or however you say his name, they would – he would indicate – Okay. Well, I'm from a predominantly German and Polish area. We pronounce things correctly. but seriously, he would point out that Welbeck is very good, that his numbers in terms of his expected goals and assists per 90 minutes are very good. But I think that is probably a little bit biased by the fact that he's a player that plays for Manchester United. And despite the fact that Manchester United were not that good last year, I think his numbers overall are inflated by playing for United. And I think he's fine. I think he would have been, you know, an acceptable player. I think he would have, you know, been a little bit of an upgrade over Chadley. But I think for the price at $16 million, I would have wanted much more. I mean, it would have been much easier to stomach if we'd have taken someone like Depay over the summer at 12 or 15 million euro before he signed his contract extension. I think that would have been much more palatable.
I think the thing we need to appreciate with Danny Welbeck is I don't know how much of it was we didn't want to pay the fee as much as it was Danny Welbeck had a better offer on the table. Not that, you know, playing for Arsenal is so wonderful, but playing in Arsenal, Danny Welbeck was going to be the replacement for an injured Olivier Giroud, and he was going to get to be their first-choice striker until Giroud got healthy and possibly beyond that. At Spurs, he was going to be playing on the left wing. And I think Danny Welbeck, as a player, you know, was happy to play as a left winger for Manchester United because they've got Rooney and RVP up top, and if he wants minutes, that's just the kind of thing he's going to have to suck it up and deal with. But to come to Spurs and play that role when he's being offered the chance to play as an out-and-out striker for Arsenal, which is his favorite position and where he thinks he's best at, you know, it's really no contest for him. I mean, he's going to want to play in his position if that's an option. And I don't think we were willing to give that to him. I think we wanted him to be kind of our Jay Rodriguez, which I think he would have been good at. I think he would have been an upgrade on Chadley. But, you know, when he's got both of those options in front of him, he's not coming to Spurs.
And, I mean, at Arsenal, he gets the chance to possibly play central defense as well, which would be a new experience for him. So, yeah.
Well, he'd be just as good as some of their other backups. So yeah, and Jay Rodriguez seems to certainly be on the back burner. I've read some reports from some journalists that his contract's up at the end of the year. In which case, even if that's not true, I think we're going back in for him in January. But we'll see. I think my guess would be left forward will probably be something we target in January, unless Harry Kane or Chadley really impress over the next few months.
Aaron Lennon.
Or Aaron Lennon. Honestly, he is. You know what? He'll do that. He will find a way to impress and make us all forget about all those players because that's what Aaron Lennon does at age 80. Now that we've given you some insightful and tactical analysis, let's lower the bar and take some questions from our listening audience. Let's start with some from Twitter. Unfit for Purpose, our clueless dictator in residence, asks, with Walker out for an unknown time after his operation, how should we deal with the right back problem? Brian, do you want to start with this?
I mean, I think the answer is pretty clearly that it's Kyle Naughton. I mean, I think one, you know, silly red card aside, I think that Naughton as a right back is acceptable. I don't think that Dyer or Kabul or Stambouli or any other player that could potentially play right back is enough of an upgrade over Kyle Walker to warrant playing them out of position, or excuse me, Kyle Naughton, to warrant playing them out of position. So I think Naughton is the answer going forward.
Ben?
You know, for the Liverpool match, I would have liked to see Naughton just because we didn't have any other center backs. And I would have liked to see Dyer come in for Kabul at center back because I thought Kabul was more of a liability than Naughton was. In hindsight, it appears to have proved me correct. Yay, me. But going forward, if we've got Fazio and he's ready to contribute, I'm not opposed to keeping Dyer at right back over Naughton. I think Naughton is good. I don't think he's, you know, the calamity that people seem to treat him as. But we also kind of know what Naughton gives us. And it's nothing special. And I think we've seen from Dyer that, yes, he's playing out of position, but he seems to be a bit more special sort of player. And I think if he can adapt, he could be a much better option there. But I won't be upset if we stick with Naughton.
I think you know, Poch is probably riding the hot hand against Liverpool. You know, Dyer had been playing in the team. He'd done well in two matches. Why not start him? I just don't think there's any great solution here against some of the better teams in the league until Walker's back. And now, as of today, we found out Walker had you know, some lower abdominal surgery, probably related to the injuries that have had before. My guess would be physical therapy just wasn't working out, because you tend not to, you know, have surgery unless it's a last-ditch option. So we're going to be stuck with one of them for a while. I think probably what we get after, depending on, Eric Dyer went down with an injury today in the U21 English camp. I'm curious how much of that was an injury and how much of that was, oh, our right back's going to be out for a few months now. You're not going to go get hurt on international duty. So, you know, we'll see. I have a feeling we'll probably see both. But I personally, I would rather go for Dyer. I think, like Ben said, there's more there. But moving on, one of a commenters on our site, a new one, Rock6G6G, which sounds like a Mega Man boss gone wrong, asks, is it unreasonable to hope for a top four finish every year? He is new to the EPL and picked Tottenham Hotspur as his team. Is he destined to live a lifetime of heartbreak? Brian, I'll let you start on this one as well, since he is a fan of the Chiefs and Royals. So try to be gentle with him.
Okay. As a fellow Royals fan, I know that he understands heartbreak. The Kansas City Royals have not been to the playoffs in my lifetime. We've had probably two winning records in my existence on this earth. Tottenham is better than that. You know, I think in terms of expecting, you know, the top four, I don't know. I don't think you're destined to the same lifetime of heartbreak that the Royals and Chiefs would subject you to. But if you're expecting to win Tottenham to win a title in the next few years, yeah, I mean, that's obviously not going to happen. But the expectations in the Premier League are much different. I think Champions League qualification is certainly within the realm of possibility in the next few seasons.
I think that's something that could happen every year. I don't think it's something that will happen every year. The economics make this very tricky. Spurs have the sixth sort of biggest payroll in England, and our position sort of reflects that. A lot of the last few years where we got so close were, I mean, obviously we had two world-class players for a lot of them, but part of that was because Liverpool just, like, shot themselves in the foot repeatedly. And now that they have their act together, that's going to be way harder. Now, you know, we're assuming they still have their act together on the back of this weekend's game. We don't know that yet. Champions League is going to be a big test for them this year.
And we got outspent by a lot of clubs this summer. I mean, teams have spent more than us. Arsenal spent more. Chelsea, Liverpool, City, United, obviously.
All with bigger grounds than us and all with bigger, deeper pocketbooks than us, which is
QPR spent more than us.
Well, that's because they're run by an insane person on every level.
Over the last 5 years, Spurs have the lowest net transfer spend of anybody in England. We've actually made a bunch of money.
Yeah. Southampton spent more this year. Hull and Everton both spent about the same. Hull City, the Tiger, spent about the same amount of money as Tottenham Hotspur this year. Only Stoke and Swansea had lower net spends. I mean, we're not, you know, Greg, you're right, Greg. I mean, we're not going out there and buying our way into the top four. Like, we just need some of this to happen organically.
Yeah, and I mean, the trick with Spurs is, I mean, we probably could honestly spend a little more money, but the trick with Spurs is where we are, because when you look at Tottenham, so Tottenham is buying players with the sort of idea that they're around top four talent. These are guys who could play in the Champions League if we had to. I think that's the idea when Tottenham buy players. Or if they're not there yet, they can be. And the problem with that is, for a lot of teams, I think you look at Moutinho a few years ago as an example of this, is if we're sniffing around, then another club, unless we've really done our homework, laid it out, and just sort of gotten in right away, another team like Porto can be like, well, if Tottenham's interested, then maybe Arsenal's interested. And maybe Arsenal can afford to spend 10 million more than Tottenham. So why don't we hold out for that? Or if we hold on to this player for another year, because Tottenham are getting in early, like we did on Sei Musashio, then we will be able to, you know, if we can hold on to this player for another year, we can sell him for more money to a Chelsea instead of a Tottenham, or a Real Madrid, or an Atletico, or whoever, instead of Tottenham. And that's the tricky position Tottenham's in.
And I think the other thing is, I think it would be almost beneficial for Spurs to sort of do a Liverpool, so to speak, to have those two or three seasons where you go drop down into the ninth or tenth place in the table. Because right now the expectation is we have a squad that is capable of finishing, you know, fifth or sixth or maybe fourth if things break right. And so for Levy and Joe Lewis, you know, they don't need to spend a lot in order to get to about the area that they want to be. And, you know, to drop down further into mid-table would almost force their hand in a way.
I don't – Liverpool was – they had a lot of money and they were bought by the Red Sox. I don't think that's happening for Spurs anytime soon.
No, I'm not saying that they need to be bought by somebody, but I'm just saying that there needs to be some pressure put on either if you are of the mentality that Spurs are not spending enough money and that they're making a profit in, you know, or having a decent net spend every transfer window is bad, then the best thing for Spurs would be to go down and force management's hand in order to try to purchase more players or to make a move.
Boy, that would be fun to watch, wouldn't it?
So I want to just real quick address his initial question, am I destined to a lifetime of heartbreak? I don't think as a Kansas City Royals fan, he has any idea what heartbreak feels like. Because in order to have your heart broken, you need to have some kind of hope and belief that you can do better. And
no, Ben, you don't understand. As a Royals fan, every spring you expect it to be better.
No, there is no plausible reason for that expectation.
No,
the Royals have had two winning records, as you said, in your entire lifetime. They're not good. They're not going to be good. To have your heart broken by that is absurd. But with Tottenham, it's we're almost good enough every single year. So they just set you up to dream that something that good can happen, and then you remember, why would anything good ever happen? And we fuck it up. So you're destined for a lifetime of heartbreak that you can't even imagine right now.
I think because as Tottenham fans, we're conditioned now anyway to be so cynical, to expect the worst things to happen, that I almost kind of forget the hope that comes with a new season.
You need to spend more time on Twitter.
Maybe, right? But I mean, like, I feel like with baseball season, like every spring training, I'm always like, oh yeah, this is the year that Kansas City will not lose 100 games.
That's a cultural thing. For Americans, there is no greater source of hope than baseball in February.
Yeah.
We're not going to be terrible this year. We're going to win the World Series this year.
And I feel like with Spurs in June, I'm always like, eh, we're going to finish sixth. So I don't know. I feel like the heartbreak comes a lot sooner when you're a Royals fan. It comes in April or May. I think Spurs break your heart after like months of building.
Yeah, they string you along and then rip your heart out of your fucking chest.
Yeah, they beat Newcastle 5-0, and then the manager doesn't do his job for 3 months. And then Chelsea wins the Champions League. Ugh. Anyway, Bailout has an interesting question. Everton, Villa, Sunderland, and Newcastle all have bigger stadiums than us. So why is it that they have not had more success, and where can we learn from their mistakes once our new stadium is complete? Ben?
I have no good answer for that.
Brian!
I mean, we also have – well, I have an answer.
Okay, well, give us your answer. Wizards did it?
Well, we also have our ownership has much more money than all of them. So that's
we're a London team, so sponsorships probably have something to play in that.
Yeah,
I would imagine.
And Joe Lewis is richer than Mike Ashley, and who owns Sunderland? I can't remember right now.
Nigel.
No, Niall Quinn is the chairman, or was. Ellis Short, is that Sunderland?
Ellis Short. Yeah, that's correct.
You know, Randy Lerner's phoned it out at Villa. Bill Kenwright's never had money at Everton. So, yes, they have stadium and that generates revenue, but we have London, we have Joe Louis. And we also have more of an established track record in recent years, at least, than, I mean, Sunderland has money, but they have only just come up in the Premier League, you know, over the past 10 years. Mike Ashley at Newcastle seems pretty content to just not get relegated again. As I said, Everton, you know,
Everton,
their chairman,
Everton arguably had a stronger base to jump off of than, like, they sort of came up at the same time we did, but like you said, Ken Wright just has no money.
They just don't have the money. And yeah. And Villa, you know, pushed alongside Spurs, and then Randy Lerner closed his pocketbook and said, sorry, no more signings. So, you know, the stadium is only one facet of what makes the team profitable and successful. You know, we are, I think, what, the 12th richest club in the world?
At one point we were. I don't know if we are now.
I think that's where we are now. It's like 11th or 12th. We're very high up there. Newcastle is like 17th, and the rest are not even near the list.
What kills it for us is that really is the missing piece for Spurs, is a bigger stadium. And it sucks because we're going to have to pay that stadium off for a few years. So, I mean, or maybe we're running it as such that we'll just be able to pay for the whole thing up front, or most of it up front, so it won't hamstring us in the way it hamstrung Arsenal for so long. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for this. Brian, do you have anything?
Well, I think that you've sort of hit on the answer in that we are a London club. I think, you know, Everton play in Liverpool, Villa plays in Birmingham, Sunderland and Newcastle are both in the Tyne Wear area. So, I mean, like, these are not – I mean, London is the most populous city in the country. I know that Birmingham is the second most, but, you know – we have a much bigger audience in terms of the people that we can draw from. Almost all of our games sell out. Everton's stadium isn't that much bigger than ours. It's only about 3,000 seats larger.
And Everton's the sort of traditional and Everton have a great history. I'm not like making fun of Everton in the way I tend to make fun of Villa, but they're kind of like the redheaded stepchild in the city of Liverpool.
Right, but they're also that's also the only two clubs in town.
Yeah, but that's why, like, I can see why that's why investors aren't coming in for Everton, whereas Liverpool was able to get the Red Sox to buy them with a ton of money. I mean,
yeah, but I mean, I think it's like you guys said. I think, you know, we have an owner who is not unwilling to spend money. We have, you know, consistently been, you know, we haven't been at or near relegation level in a long time. I mean, Newcastle went down. Sunderland has gone down recently. Aston Villa, I don't think, has ever been relegated from the top flight. That might be wrong.
I think they were. I think Everton's the only club that hasn't been.
Perhaps it's Everton. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, so Sunderland, Newcastle have had some down years, you know, as recently as, you know, 2000. I think Newcastle went down in what, 2008?
Yeah, not that long ago. 2009, was it?
Yeah, somewhere in there, Newcastle went down, and Sunderland were down around that same time too, I believe. So, I mean, it's not just the stadium size, like you guys said. It's a combination of other things.
And it's a thing that, you know, for all the shit that Daniel Levy gets, I mean, I think those comparisons should remind us how good we have it when it comes to our chairman. Like, could they be doing more? Could we spend a little bit more? Yes, absolutely. The money's there. You know, we could splash out a little more, go maybe a little more in debt. But by and large, they're doing an excellent job running the club compared to the teams who should be around us in the table.
Yeah, I agree with that. Let's see. I think we have time for a few more questions. Let's see. If you found out, this comes from Day of the Trifics, which might be one of the better usernames on the site. If you found out that a Sky Sports news reporter was outside the gates of the training ground of your local club, how would you top the sterling example of top banter set on this transfer deadline day? Which was, of course, the purple dildo being put in the Sky Sports reporter's ear. Ben,
I mean, I don't.
Or Brian, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I just
go ahead, Brian.
I don't think that can actually be topped. I don't. I mean, short of something extremely absurd,
someone's actual cock in the ear of a Sky Sports reporter.
I suppose that is the only way to go above and beyond that. I mean, short of, you know, something that would get you arrested. Well, that would get you arrested. But, like, I think journalism has hit an all-time low. I don't think, you know, you're doing your job and you get a dildo in your ear. That's
what
I wouldn't push that on anyone.
What if you go to interview Harry Redknapp coming out of his car window and he just waves a dildo in your ear from his car window? Would that be lower?
I think yes. No, knowing Sandra and the kind of finisher that she is. yeah, that's worse.
Oh my. Oh dear. Oh dear. That would get on Sky Sports, I hope, one day. We can dream. That is Brian, that is some hashtag top banter right there. That is some quality bands.
Thank you.
I think we can only hope to duplicate that. Final question, everyone, that I think is very relevant and important, and, you know, after the last week. This comes from Joshua Taylor on the Twitter machine. Why is Liverpool the worst? Ben, you start us off.
Because Brendan Rodgers' lips are the same color as his face, and it's fucking weird.
Brendan Rodgers is a sentient potato. I mean, it's like
seriously,
it's like they stuffed up, not Mr. Potato Head, like an actual potato that just sticks out of his suit with all a right. bad wig on it.
Seriously, look at a picture of Brendan Rodgers. His lips are flesh colored, and it's freaky as hell.
Brian.
Well, hold on. I'm Googling Brendan Rodgers. I think they're the worst because of their fans.
Yes. Nailed it. Bingo.
Because they are like Spurs fans, but much more
horrible?
Angry. Yes. Horrible. Deluded. Angry. Yes. Yeah.
They're more entitled.
Yeah, I don't know if it's this whole you'll never walk alone thing or what. Look, because Spurs fans are annoying because, to me, as a Spurs fan, the people that are annoying are the ones that latch on to that, you know, the game is about glory and to dare is to do. And, like, when we play defensive football, like, we've made an offense against the history of the club. And then Liverpool has this "you'll never walk alone" motto, which apparently means defending racists and people that bite each other during football matches. I think it's the fans that make Liverpool the worst.
Here's the thing, and to our British listeners, I apologize. I'm probably going to lose you here. The problem with Liverpool fans is it's like someone in a lab found a way to combine the worst things about Yankee fans, their entitlement, their arrogance, and combine them with the sort of victim complex of a Red Sox fan and turn that into an entire fan base. They are the most successful club in English history, and they act like there's a conspiracy out to get them. Now, I do understand that there actually was a conspiracy out to get people who lived in Liverpool in the 80s, but that football club is the most successful football club in English history. Like,
no, they're not.
No, yes, they are. They've won.
United's won more titles.
Yes, and they've won 5 champions or European Cups and almost as many titles.
Well, they've won less.
Whatever. My point is, they are one of the most successful clubs in European football. No one is out to get you.
I've just spent the last couple of minutes Googling pictures of Brendan Rodgers, and his lips are very disconcerting.
Do you think that's why he has a portrait of himself? Like, so you can just see that every day?
I don't know why you would want to.
I think, yeah, if my lips looked like that, I would not want a picture of myself.
Maybe he has lips painted onto that picture, and that's why it's a portrait and not a picture.
I mean, that's entirely possible.
I think we should put on our tinfoil hats next time we play Liverpool and examine this in more depth. But until then, I am Skipjack. For my co-hosts, Brian Ashlock and Ben Daniels, this has been another episode of Wheeler Dealer Radio. Come on, you Spurs. We'll be right back.